Welcome to the Best of Times podcast. My name is John Doran. Over the coming months, I'm going to be talking to people about some of the best and worst times they have been through, and hopefully find out how these experiences have made them who they are today. So far, I've interviewed Sleaford Mods, The Specials, and Kristen Hirsch. Today's guest is Roisin Murphy. Roisin grew up in Arklow, Ireland, but moved with her family to Manchester when she was just 12. She formed the group Moloco with Mark Bryden in 1995, straddling the pop, art rock, trip-hop divide, cementing their place in the popular consciousness with the tracks Sing It Back, The Time Is Now, and Familiar Feeling. Her solo career since has provided evidence of a restless creative mind, and she's released music ranging from the left-field pop of Ruby Blue, made with tech jazz producer Matthew Herbert, to a recent series of sumptuous deep house EPs, made in conjunction with Morris Fulton. She has recently moved into filmmaking and has a new single out this spring made with Parrot from Sheffield electronic mainstays All Seeing Eye. Roisin.
Yes.
Tell me about the best of times.
Okay, well, to tell you about the best of times, I think I'd like to lead in with one of the worst of times, which would be in Moloco. I was girlfriend and boyfriend. We were girlfriend and boyfriend, myself and Mark Bryden, and we broke up just before we made our last album, Statues. And I think we started making that in 2002. It took about a year to make, and it was post breakup, was very raw emotions flying around, lots of sort of like trying to figure out where people sat and lay in the power structure of things, and a total obsessional about making a fantastic album as well, obviously. Incredible amount of energy, and was fraught, terribly fraught to make. And we managed to do it, and we put it out, and it wasn't actually as much of a success as it felt like it was going to be. But we did feel we'd achieved something musically. After that, touring that, we toured the biggest tours we've ever done, actually. So there was a kind of irony there. It was a little bit of a damp squid putting out the record. But then we went into this tour and it was like all the biggest gigs we've ever done.
But when, you see, for most people who are hearing this, I certainly for myself, I would think, oh, if I was just about to split up with a partner, you know, a long-term partner, the last thing I'd want to do would be to launch into a creative project with them. I mean, like, how did you?
It's all we knew. Yeah. It's all we knew. We'd been together for 7-8 years before that, and Moloco started simultaneously with the relationship. It literally started on the same night. So I went up to him, as I'd been going up to all these people at this house party in Sheffield, and just going, "Do you like my tight sweater?" Because it just got into my head and it was going around my head. And that turned out to be my chat-up line. And also, he took me to his big studio that night, Fon Studios, which he partly built. It was quite a famous studio in Sheffield, but it was
so
the middle
was
of the night.
He was in Chac, wasn't he?
He was in Chac. Yeah, yeah. And from the money from Chac, which was signed to a major label, they built Fon. Well, they built the first Fon. I went to the second Fon, which is an even more glamorous thing than the first one. And it was a very famous studio for like people who were into it. It was a big, fancy, classical studio, but it was a little bit more skewed toward people who wanted to sample stuff and, you know, make beats and things like that than most of the big studios in the north of England. So people used to come from all over to go to Fon. But it was the middle of the night, obviously, when I met him in this party, and it was downtime. So he took me there in the middle of the night, almost like just a show-off trip, really, I think, just to show me his big studio, his big equipment. And I just chanted this thing over the top. And that night we started to see each other. And regularly then, thereafter, going to a party, you know, some stupid thing started coming out of my mouth, and we would go in the studio and I would say, pretend to be a valley girl talking about party weirdos or whatever. And that, a few of those little stupid things we did, and it was really just not even thinking about what we were doing. And his manager took those tracks, or gathered these tracks together with a couple of instrumental tracks, and brought it to London and played it to people as a project before I even knew. I didn't know he was doing that. Anyway, so as I mean that 7 or 8 years prior to this, we started simultaneously making music in a way that was very experimental and open-minded, yeah. And we got to this point after Sing It Back and Time Is Now and, you know, Sing It Back being a remix and lots of drama the couple of years before Statues. And we got to the point where it broke up, the relationship broke up. And we didn't know any different. We just knew how to make... I certainly didn't. I had no idea even if I could make music with anyone else. I mean, I just literally had no clue, because it had been such a surprise for me to even start doing it in the first place with him. And so I guess out of just fear, you know, we thought, let's make another make a record.
When you get like, obviously most people don't experience the thing of like living and working with the partners. Mm. Is it possible for you to kind of disentangle the good stuff from the bad stuff? Is it something where you look back and say, well, I'd never do that again?
No. I mean, it was my total saving grace. He saw something in me that I didn't even see in myself. And even to the point where I was signing the deal. And the deal was for 6 albums. And Mark, who was a very experienced producer, had had lots of record deals and blah before that. And I said to him, really, you want me to, what are you talking about? You want us to sign a 6 album deal? And he just looked at me very simply and said, if we get to 6 albums, something has gone very right. You really don't need to worry about it. Just, let's just do this. And on we went.
So despite all this stuff going on in the background, you've said that like actually touring this album was some of the best times. So what were some of the highlights?
Well, geez, we did some, you know, we did big Glastonbury, and we did things like Exit Festival when it was just starting out, and we headlined it, and, you know, we played festival shows that were like 75,000 people in front of us and stuff, and all over Europe. And we just got into a point where we were just doing gig after gig after gig, and then jump, and then just getting it right, just, and then doing rehearsals, and then having a great lighting guy, and just it fell together as a thing that we were doing, and with the best band, and it really was some of the best times as an artist ever, those gigs. And there was this tinge of sadness underneath it, that it was coming to an end. It was coming to an end. We all knew it was coming to an end. It was coming to an end. And actually, when we did the very last gig, the last gig we did was in Turkey. And we'd come and gone to Turkey during that year, and we'd all fallen in love with Turkey. And yeah, so it turned up there. I'd actually fallen in love with a guy in Turkey. Thought I had, a couple of gigs before, and the next time I went back to Istanbul, this was not the last gig, but the next time I went back to Istanbul, the time before the very last gig, I met this guy again, and it had my name tattooed all over him and stuff, and it really freaked me out, and he turned out to be a real weirdo. So the last gig, I thought he was actually going to turn up with a gun and sniper me or something from the stage, which was funny. But the other thing that was funny about the last gig was, as I said, there was this, we're having the best time of our lives, but there was this undercurrent all the time. It's finishing, it's going to finish. And maybe undercurrent being, it's probably all Roisin's fault that it's going to finish as well, you know. So we got to this place in Turkey, the very last gig. Now, hang on. Eddie Stevens, who's my musical director and one of my very closest friends ever in the whole world, like a brother, he started saying, in the airport in Heathrow, we've got to get so absolutely shit-faced. It's the last gig ever. So they all started drinking gin, like insane amount of gin. We got to the place in Turkey, which was not Istanbul. It was in the countryside. It was maybe, you know, one of the beach places. And guy turned up with like a little splitter bus. And we says, oh, how long is it going to take to get to the hotel? So he says, 45 minutes. 4 hours later, we were up a pitch black dark, up a mountain, just driving round and round in the pitch black dark. Man was totally lost, right? Everyone in the band was screaming at each other, killing each other. I mean, going for it like, I hate you because of this and I hate you because of that. This was the night before the last gig. Just got trapped in this blackness of despair. And me crying and crying my eyes out. Stopped the bus when I saw a shop, finally, after 4 hours of fighting. And called a taxi from there. And we followed the taxi. We were like literally 7 minutes away from the hotel all along.
Oh, man.
So nobody was talking to each other the next day. I was sitting at the beach, you know, looking out at the sea, wondering what everything meant, you know, what was for me, what was in store for me. Would I have a career? Why did they all hate me? You know, everything basically. And then one by one, they came to me that day and they were like, oh, sorry about last night. It all got a bit emotional. And then we did the gig in Turkey and we just did this gig where I thought I was going to be killed. But it was the best gig ever. And then afterwards, we were all in the sea and the crew were all wearing my underwear in the sea. And it was like,
oh yeah, what one
you
of
know,
that?
And it was just back to being the best of times again. And then, yeah, so those were really great times. But with this sort of undercurrent of it's all going to get taken away. And I was not sure if I had it in me without my boyfriend beside me, as he had been for the last 7 or 8 years, to you know, had I made the right decision to just go for it when, you know, I had already thought from being a child that I would do something visual, that I would be a visual artist. And I guess, you know, I took every opportunity to be a visual artist in the music field. But I wasn't sure whether I shouldn't have just listened to my first response and gone to art school and not done this deal and just totally been diverted into music, you know. So yeah, it was scary times in that way.
But you hit the ground running as a solo artist, didn't you?
Hit the ground running, back in the big time. well, you know, I did what I always do, really, which is just sort of just glance to the side, I guess, just shortly to the side of me. And there was Matthew Herbert, who had done a couple of remixes for us and they'd been really successful. And who had said to me a couple of years before, you know, when you get a chance, we should do some music together. And so I just sort of did that. And that turned into just an absolute revelation of realizing that I could do this, you know.
So for those who don't know, Matthew Herbert is a very, very individual composer and music maker and remixer, isn't he?
Mm. He's quite jazzy.
Yeah. So, like, what did he bring to bear for Blue Ruby? Because you've suggested it's only a slight change, but actually it's like a really big change, isn't it?
It wasn't really a huge change.
Okay.
No.
Right.
I mean, I've had the record I did after that, which was with EMI, Overpowered, that was totally different.
Yeah, yeah.
That was working with lots and lots of different people. It was working in a way that how people make pop records. That's how I made Ruby Blue. That's how I made Overpowered, in a way that people make pop music, pop records, albums. Vast amounts of people and resources involved in it.
Did he use any particular kind of like production innovations?
Yeah, he has a way. He has his dogmas, you know. He said to me, just like an hour before I came in for the first session, bring something in that means something to you. And I had no idea what he was talking about, what he meant. So I happened to be reading an article about Brian Eno, something to do with Brian Eno and The Long Now, where he had placed a clock into a cliff or something. And the clock was to count for 700 years, you know, and it was a statement about stretching time, about how time kind of contracts, depending on what you're thinking about and stuff like that. So I thought this brought that in he said, "Oh, what did you bring in?" I said, "Oh, look at this. You're an intellectual producer. Look at this. Brian Eno's intellectual and all in. So he's right clever." And he went, "Yeah, that's very interesting. But you just bang it across the microphone." And with that, it just became an instrument. And then after that, I have to bring in things all the time from the house, bring in hairspray cans and makeup and ornaments and all sorts of rubbish that I brought in, pots and pans. And so it started with a sense of, I'm taking the very bits of you and the very bits of your life, and I'm going to make a very intimate sonic landscape, really, for you to sing about intimate stuff on top of, you know. And so it felt very much like that the music almost came out, not just out of these things that belonged to me, but because I was actually manipulating the things too, out of my body, out of everything was out of my rhythm and out of what I, so even the sounds were what I was saying. For someone who was insecure about, you know, I've got to go in there and write a pop song, or I've got to go in there and write an incredible song in front of someone I don't know or whatever, he broke it down into these component parts that I just forgot about all that insecurity, and it just became, this is a Matthew Herbert study of what is actually sitting here in his studio. It doesn't really matter in a way what I bring. I just have to bring myself. So it sort of took a lot of pressure off, you know. And it was interesting outside of myself. And so that took pressure off too, which often the case.
Rasheen, tell me about the worst of times.
And then, you know, I was with this label, you see, so with Moloco all these years too. So from the age of 19, as I told you, I signed this label, 6-album deal. And I delivered Ruby Blue to them, and they just acted like people I hadn't known for 7-8 years. I mean, these people I'd known since I was a kid, and they were all acting weird. Like, it was a shock, because I just genuinely haven't come out of a cynical place making music. I've come out of a really open-minded, like, I went into it thinking more like a kind of conceptual artist than a musician or whatever, and just going, what if I do this and I do that, and just fuddling through and finding out stuff by experimenting. And the label had always allowed that in Moloco. But when I delivered this, they all acted totally different to me, and I couldn't get my head around it. It was really odd, and I ended up being dropped from the label, and I was actually in Belgium the day that they dropped me, doing press for Ruby Blue, and I was with the label who were licensing the record. And thank God I was, because they just turned out to be absolute rocks. It was Play It Again, Sam. And they were just like, don't worry about that. We're going to stick by you. This is going to be a huge record here. You know, we're going to work through this. And actually, years later, I remembered this fabulous way that they treated me on that day. And I was crying. It was like, I felt like somebody had finished with me. I really felt like the breakup again had happened again almost, you know.
So it's really interesting. Well, interesting is probably not the right word. I mean, it's kind of sad, really, looking back at it, because it's such a unique album, but it totally failed to connect with an audience. Do you see that as like a lack of duty and care on the part of the record company's fault?
Or yeah, I think they just gave up before they'd even started on it. That's what I do think. And that, you know, I couldn't have just carried, you know, the reason why it got dropped, because I didn't want them to use a remix. The first remix that they had done, I was like, it's not a good remix, and it's not the direction in which we should be promoting this record. Nobody's comfortable with it, neither myself nor Matthew. And they were like, toys went straight out of the cot. Like, straight away, it was like, because it was just so paranoid about every penny that they were spending, because they were really up against it. No, Ruby Blue would have needed to do well in that moment, or to do well enough for Echo to feel comfortable. They needed to put an awful lot more deliberate marketing behind it than was given to it. And But it had a life of its own anyway, and like Rambalama Bang Bang became this huge sort of dance smash thing that happened out of America, of this TV show, So You Think You Can Dance. They did a routine for it, and then it just became like a gazillion, million, billion routines are on YouTube to this song, all in America. So in a way, it's a weird song, Rambalama Bang Bang, but it went into probably my most mainstream places that I've ever been in, with right through an American culture that most of the music hasn't touched. So, interesting.
I love the stuff you were doing on EMI, you know what I mean? Like, your first album, like, it was full of bangers. Like, were you happy at that label?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whew, are you kidding? I mean, that'd be another best of times, you know? It was it was candy and it was just sweet shop, you know? It was like, it was supermarket sweep. It was like, get in there, get whatever you want. It's all... And it was a massive achievement because, you know, really, they let me produce the record, and it didn't. We're talking about Overpowered now.
Yeah,
it didn't fall apart, you know, under my guidance. It stayed together. It cost a bloody fortune, but I was going Miami one minute, Barcelona the next to work with so and so. Recorded strings in Philadelphia with Larry Gold. If I didn't like the mix that was done in America, I could take it back here and have it done, you know, a massive studio here with another guy. You know, it was wonderful. It was a chance. It was something that I learned so much from that thing in terms of how you walk in with a straight back into a new situation and just write your songs and have your goals set before you go in, and tracks to play to people and inspiring people and being a boss, like really being a boss in a way that I can't boss Matthew Herbert, I can't boss Maurice Fulton, I can't boss DJ Coz, I can't boss any of these people. I can work with them and I can collaborate with them, but with Overpowered, they were all being paid so much, I could boss them.
And crack the whip, yeah.
I could, and I could say, no, I don't like your mix. I got to take it to so-and-so. He'll do what I tell him, and things like that. So it was great. I would say that the first sort of big session I did for that, well, no, I mean, I was doing sessions with Seiji, who I did most of the record with, right from the beginning, but outside of the Seiji situation, that was like a home route. Seiji was there in West London, close by his little studio like this that we're sitting in. That was always there. That was an anchorage. But the first sort of real tryout thing that I did was at the behest of the label with Calvin Harris. He was straight out of the... He was a young lad, you know. Yeah. Looked like a goth from like Aberdeen. bit snotty and that.
Yeah.
And you know, he'd never had anything out. And, you know, I've got loads of respect for him as a producer, actually. I think he's really, 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 really talented. And so I was like, yeah, I like what I'm hearing. I'll go in with him and Kathy Dennis. So nice. The three of us, you know, and to see Kathy Dennis come in and just quietly go straight in and start singing just what's totally in the top of a gut about, you know, about a song, to try and make up a song type thing and not really care what anyone thinks and stuff like that. It was ideal that I saw that so early on in the setup. I did not use the songs from that session for one reason or another, perhaps because I'm mad, but I didn't use them on Overpowered. But seeing her do that, and then I had that kind of image every time I went to another studio place in America, famous people, this, blah, 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 that, so-and-so, this, you know. I took it with me, this kind of image of this kind of, she sort of like, you wouldn't expect it from her type thing. She just comes in, just like that. Wow, Jesus, that's so funky, you know. And it was great for me to see that.
The inner gatefold sleeve of I Am Not a Doctor.
Aye.
You've got to talk me through this. So for those who haven't had the privilege, Roisin is wearing a full suit of armour and appears to be milking a Frisian cow in front of a slightly fascistic looking Swiss Alpine mountain scenario.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
We actually did it. I mean, it's, you know, even then, we came home we did it in Switzerland on the top of a freezing cold mountain. I was dressed in, as you said, in the armour. They brought the cow from the other side of Switzerland. They had cows that side, but they didn't have black and white cows. So he had to come from the other side of Switzerland with his own farmer, stroke lover, actually. Right. And we took the cow up the mountain in the ski lift and everything.
Hang on. What sort of ski lift?
Like one that you get inside, carriage. Yeah. Cow in there, up the mountain. Bob's your uncle. Got home, realised you could have actually done it all
Photoshop.
Because actually Photoshop even existed then. You know, I know it was a long time ago, but it was actually in its full-on stages by then. You could definitely have done it. But no, we actually did that ridiculousness. It's been marvellous, eh? This is what I mean, you know, you could never be Maloko now and be on a second album and be spending that kind of money taking a bloody cow up in a ski lift.
So what have you learned from all of this? These good times, these bad times, like, have they kind of like fed into who you were as an artist in 2019?
Yeah. I mean, every single thread of it counts now at this stage. It remains that music is the centre of it all, and I'm very lucky that it is, and it's only an accident that it is. But the more the years go by, the more I realise that everyone, whether they make film or they do paintings or whatever it is that they need, they all need music. Yeah, music is like a central element, you know. It's special. It's even special among art forms. And I just feel tremendously blessed and lucky that it could be that's the very centre of what I do, and that everything else sort of peels off of that. So I shall never forget that's my main business, is making tunes.
So you've just come out of a period where you've done 4 EPs with Morris Fulton, really, really brilliant stuff, and you've got a new single coming out soon.
Yeah.
But is it along a similar vibe? Or?
Well, the new single is with Parrot, who's like a guy from Sheffield I've known since I was a kid, and done other tracks with him, sort of one-off tracks, something called Jealousy, one called Simulation. He's a guy from All Seeing Eye. But Parrot is really a kind of big figure in Sheffield. He also puts out under the name of Crooked Man on DFS. And he's like, you know, he's a very big kind of uncle figure for me, you know. I always go back to him regularly. I just go back, do a tune here, do a tune there. He's a no-nonsense Sheffield brutalist, you know, producer. That's it, that's done. Come on, just move on. Let's do the next one. There's no nonsense. There's absolutely no nonsense. So anyway, the track is called Incapable, and it's been out on a piece of vinyl on his label, The Bitter End, that he puts out vinyl. He doesn't put anyone's name on it or anything like that. So it's been out. We've noticed that it did quite well. And now Skint, through a friend of ours who runs a label called Skint, is putting it out in springtime.
Yeah.
And it's a disco. Yeah, it's disco club house track.
So I'm really interested in this. Like, I believe your parents were kind of quite larger than life.
Very
figures.
Much so,
can
yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about them and growing up in Ireland?
Well, my parents weren't religious. They were aspirational. My dad had his own business. He made bar furniture, so he sort of kitted out all the bars with sort of sumptuous disco, comfortable lounge seating, you know, throughout the 60s and 70s. Half the bars in Ireland, honestly, he did. Which allowed him to live in night culture, I think, for most of his life. And my mum, very beautiful film star looking woman and glamorous. And they have the most incredible stories. I mean, the whole thing. And I want to make a film about it. I desperately want to make a feature film about that time in Ireland, say through the 70s, 80s. I came from a town where we had almost full employment. We had loads of factories. And the difference between it then and now is unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. It's just an unbelievable fall from grace. And coming out of the 60s and everything and all the sort of walls and past that had to be torn down by people like my father and my mother and their generation, their peers. And yet the sort of older things staying with the culture as well, the singing and the real Irish sort of old culture and the new culture of the aspiration of the new. Just lovely juxtapositions and just a kind of image of Ireland that people don't have. A modernist, sort of sexy image of Ireland in a way that you don't see in films and things, that I've got a bit of a want on me to do something about it.
How old were you when you all kind of moved over to Manchester?
I was 12 when we moved to Manchester.
Did you find that difficult?
No, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. My family broke up when I was 14, 15 in Manchester. Mum and Dad broke up and they went different ways and I stayed in Manchester because I loved it so much. Stayed on my own. Got a flat. The first day I was 16 and moved into a flat. I was living with friends before that, friend's mum.
Do you think it's had like a sort of profound effect on who you are as an adult, living on your own from such a kind of young age?
Yeah, obviously. I think, well, I just already proved I was strong by the time I was 16. That was done. That was done. Just everybody go, she's strong, she's strong. And that's it. So that's stayed with me, I guess, just knowing that. And then, but I would say it was music that kept me there, you know? It was really getting in with these lads, 14 years old. I mean, I'd always gotten into trouble in school. I'd always gotten into scraps and being bullied. And I'd always go with the naughty girls and then end up getting in trouble with the naughty girls and being ostracised. And it just happened over and over again to me growing up. All my own fault. But it happened over and over again. And at the age of 14, I just found this guy, friend Duncan, who was a weirdo, was into Jesus and Mary Chain. I just surrounded myself with lads who looked like they were in the Jesus and Mary Chain. And from there, was able to build a life, really, that was of my own making, completely from my own thing, that wasn't what the girls were doing in school and this and that. It was really deliberately a counter step, you know, a step to an alternative way of, you know, of being, you know, being into music, being into art, being into clever films, And then I started to educate myself because I just was rubbish in school, but from about the age of 14, 15, that was when I started learning. And it was really to do with music to start with too. I mean, the first thing that happened was going to see Sonic Youth and then...
Which year was that?
It was Daydream Nation. Oh, so nice. It was probably 87, 88.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was only a little kid.
Sat on that kick? Was that at the International?
Yeah.
Yeah, with Mudhoney.
With Mudhoney, yeah.
That was amazing.
Oh, my God, it was amazing. I can't believe you were at it.
They did
I want to be your dog.
Yeah, that's the encore.
At the end, yeah.
Amazing, yeah.
And so after that gig, everything changed for me. I was just like, that's it now. This is the life for me. This is what I want. And not really knowing what that meant, couldn't really have put that into what that was going to mean to me, but I just knew that was the way I was going to go. I was going to be a weirdo. I was into the Mudhoney. I was Dinosaur Jr. I was into Big Black, Butthole Surfers.
Brilliant.
Obviously the Mary Chain, big for us. And then on from there, Spaceman 3, Loop, things like that.
Yeah.
That's what we were into. Yeah. But I was then, you know, quite quickly going to see Black Uhuru and like lots of reggae and stuff in Manchester. And then quite quickly after that, going to clubs and got into electronic music that way. So Manchester, you could not, at that time in the late 80s, you couldn't fault it for what you could experience musically if you wanted to. And if you were free, and I was, to go wherever I liked. I roamed everywhere, up, down, all over that city. Terribly dangerous places I found myself in at a very young age. When I look back, if it was my daughter, I don't know if I could cope. But nothing ever happened. I was protected by music.
On that quote from an inspirational poster. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Best of Times with me, John Doran, brought to you by Lush and The Quietus. This podcast was produced and engineered by Louise London and co-produced by Andrew Payne. The theme music is by Oh The Guilt. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, give us a star rating, tweet about us and tell your friends and family. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with more Best of Times.